You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll dig into the origin story, and there are some questions about the story behind how Eau Claire got its name.
First, Governor Scott Walker said yesterday that there is an agreement in principle to end the impasse over the state's budget. The budget was due on July 1st. Laurel White is WPR's state capitol reporter, and she's with us now for an update on that budget. Laurel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So, Laurel, it has been 7 weeks. It's kind of a long time. I guess early on I was thinking about it in terms of expecting a baby, but it's not that urgent, but it's starting to feel kind of urgent. It's been 7 weeks. So the governor has said, in principle, there is a budget deal. What does that mean, in principle?
Well, so the governor was talking to reporters in Madison yesterday when he said that, and when he kind of extrapolated a little bit on that in principle comment, he said there are a few details left to work out on the state budget, but in his opinion, there isn't anything that will, quote, stop or impede the process. And he mentioned that the state budget writing committee, the Joint Finance Committee, is actually scheduled to meet tomorrow, so later this week. And he said that that was a good sign that the budget is moving forward, that lawmakers are finding consensus and are confident enough to kind of reconvene those meetings. Because some folks might know that the State Budget Committee hasn't met for more than 2 months now because there have been some kind of behind-the-scenes disagreements about the remaining parts of the state budget.
And there have been some sticking points of note in this whole process. There have been issues about transportation. That has been sort of the biggest, highest ticket item there. Foxconn, there were details to be hammered out there. And taxes, issues about property taxes and fees on vehicles, that kinds of things. What has the governor had to say about the budget and what's in it, what he's looking at?
So the governor gave us three details about the state budget yesterday, kind of a glimpse at those. They often feel like behind-the-scenes conversations. We get to talk to legislative leaders sometimes when they come out after the meetings and ask them questions, but there's a lot going on that the press and the general public isn't aware of as lawmakers kind of go back and forth on what they want. So the governor gave us three details, three insights yesterday. He says that the personal property tax, which is something that's been really important to the state Senate, will be partially repealed, at least at this stage in negotiations. Now, the personal property tax is just a tax that some businesses, not all businesses, pay on their equipment that they have. So like a grocery store paying for those freezer units or something like that. And that generates about $250 million a year for the state, the entirety of the personal property tax. And when we talked to the governor yesterday, he gave a little bit of insight into why it's important to the state Senate. I think we have a clip of that.
Here it is.
A number of senators felt it was really important to have some component of relief, particularly for small businesses, when it comes to the personal property tax, to show that there's not only for a major project like Foxconn, that we care and interest in not only a company that brings 13,000 jobs, but a company that might have 13 jobs, that there was an equal interest in helping those employers grow and prosper here in the state of Wisconsin.
And Laurel, based on what the governor said, what he's indicated so far, does he have the support for that?
Well, you know, we're still going back and forth, obviously. Nobody knows for sure. But what the governor said yesterday is that there's going to be a partial repeal of that. So the senators that the governor was mentioning in that clip there, have really pushed for the entirety of the personal property tax to go away. But what the governor said yesterday is, you know, just bits and pieces. So that would be specific businesses, specific industries that would be given a pass on paying that particular tax. So the specifics on what those businesses would be and how much the cut would actually amount to are still to be determined when the budget committee takes that up.
Now, the governor has sounded a little bit more optimistic about things being ready to go in the future than others. For instance, you have had Representative John Nygren, Joint Finance Committee Chair. What has he said?
Yeah, so yesterday we talked to the governor in the morning, and then Representative Nygren was at that public hearing on the Foxconn package. So reporters were able to approach him and say, you know, the governor says there's a deal in principle on the state budget. What do you, as co-chair of the state budget committee, think? Are you actually close to a deal, or is the deal there? And he said that there's a framework for the budget, but he didn't paint quite as rosy of a picture as the governor did. And I think we've got a clip of John Nygren as well.
So there's been some tweets this morning. I would say there's been discussion and good discussion, and there's framework in place where, you know, general conversations have got us to a place where we're pretty close. But to say we have a deal right now, I think would be premature. Until I hear it from both leaders and the governor's office, I would say that's premature.
And I've heard that same sort of language being echoed with Robin Voss and Scott Fitzgerald in the Assembly and the Senate. So I don't know, where do you put the balance of things as they stand today?
Well, you know, the Wisconsin State Journal did talk to both Speaker Voss and Senate Majority Leader Scott Fitzgerald yesterday. I wasn't lucky enough to snag them, but they did seem to be more on the page of Representative John Nygren. Speaker Voss told the State Journal, there are ideas that are out there, but there aren't a lot of, quote, rock-solid agreements yet. So I think the consensus for legislative leaders is that there's still a lot of back and forth, and something that the other co-chair of the Budget Committee, Alberta Darling, who's a senator, said yesterday to reporters is that the leaders really still have to go back to their caucuses, the groups of Republicans and in the different chambers, and talk about specific things like that personal property tax repeal and what industries they'd be comfortable with rolling it back for example. So I think the leaders are just saying we've got some more work to do. We've got some more details to iron out.
We're talking to Laurel White right now, WPR State Capitol reporter, with an update on the state budget after Governor Walker said there was a deal, quote, in principle. And transportation funding, before the Foxconn news broke, transportation, all eyes were on that. It was where the biggest, it seemed like the biggest impasse was. Are we past that? Where are things?
Well, you know, really, in a lot of ways, we're still in the same place with the transportation budget debate. There have been two things that have been the sticking points all along, and that's the amount of borrowing that the state is going to do for the state transportation budget and possible new revenue for the state transportation budget. So the new revenue would be something like a gas tax increase or a vehicle registration fee increase. And the state Senate and the state assembly still haven't come to an agreement on either of those two things. The Senate wanted about $700 million in bonding the last time they came out with an official stance on that borrowing. The Assembly wants $0 in bonding. So there's a pretty wide gap there. The governor told us yesterday that the negotiations are leaning a little bit more toward the Assembly right now. It's kind of a lower number than that $700 million. So there is some movement there. The Assembly was the force that was really pushing for that new revenue, too, the gas tax increase possibly, and those are off the table, but there is something that would be new revenue on the table, according to the governor and the legislative leaders, and that's a fee on electric vehicles in Wisconsin.
And is that considered controversial, or is that something that all sides can agree upon?
Well, it's something that the Republican legislative leaders have all said they're interested in taking a look at and kind of examining more. Speaker Voss said yesterday that he likes the idea of it in theory because it's a fee to support the maintenance of roads that electric vehicle folks would pay, that a lot of people pay via the gas tax. So electric vehicles are obviously using the roads. They're causing wear on the roads, but their drivers aren't paying to support roads through the gas tax. So that's kind of part of the debate that people are engaging in right now around that vehicle registration fee.
And from what I understand, the fee would be, as it stands now, $50 in addition to the $75 registration fee. So it's some revenue, could be substantial, but not as substantial as some of these other options that were in favor in, say, the Assembly or the Senate.
That's right, yeah, and obviously that's still very mutable right now. It could change a whole lot, the amount of that fee increase in the coming weeks, because as everybody's telling us, there's still a lot of discussion behind closed doors about how much they're looking for and how much others are comfortable with.
Now, the legislature's budget committee is meeting again starting tomorrow. What do you expect out of that meeting?
Well, this should be a really fun meeting. It's a reunion for everybody. We haven't gotten together with the Joint Finance Committee since June 15th. So they're not taking up any of the big ticket issues. They're not taking up transportation or taxes or K-12 education. Those are the big things, of course, that are still kind of up in the air for the state budget. But they will be taking up the Department of Natural Resources budgets and elements of that. And the biggest, most high-profile thing they're taking up tomorrow is a repeal of the forestry mill tax, which is the state's portion of property tax bills in Wisconsin.
And Laurel, before we let you go, in other state news today, you spent the day with State Superintendent Tony Evers as he announced his campaign for Wisconsin governor formally. What did he say?
So Evers really stressed this morning his expertise in education. He talked about how education will apply to all facets of government. Basically, he was saying if we educate our children in Wisconsin well, it's going to benefit our economy. That's going to lead to more jobs. So he really pushed his experience. He's in his third term right now as the state school superintendent. And he also talked about working across the aisle as the state school superintendent. That's a nonpartisan office. So he said that as governor, he would really work with Democrats and Republicans and be a coalition builder.
Laurel, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you next time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
That was Laurel White, WPR State Capitol reporter, with us for an update on the state budget. For a few hundred years, it's been believed that Eau Claire got its name from French voyageurs who marveled at the clear water they found there. However, the true origin of the city's name may be a bit muddier than that.
Our next guest did some of his own exploring and discovered that Eau Claire's name may have different roots. Joining us now is Tom Giffey, managing editor for Volume 1. You can find his article on the naming of Eau Claire linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Tom, welcome back to Central Time.
It's good to be here.
Well, before we get to what is probably the true story, tell us what we used to believe. What's the traditional story that Eau Claire school kids are brought up believing?
Right, and it was something that I've been a journalist up here for going on 18 years, and it was something I just sort of accepted as fact because it's one of those things that people tell you when you come to town and you're first learning about it. Essentially, it is that it was 250 years ago this very summer. Jonathan Carver, who is a colonial American, hired sort of indirectly by the British Crown to explore this area, which, the French had been running around in trading furs for about a century, but he was the first American or British person to explore the area. Hired some voyageurs and came up the Chippewa River from the Mississippi, and as legend goes, they ran into the Eau Claire River, which flows into the Chippewa right here in downtown Eau Claire, just a few blocks from where my office is. And apparently, because of kind of late spring rains, the Chippewa River was kind of a muddy coffee color, and they had found this beautiful clear water flowing in from the Eau Claire. And several of the older history books I found, they even have a long French quote, which I will not attempt to pronounce the French over the air, but it's basically the voyageurs, waving their chapeaux in the air and shouting, "Clear water, we have clear water, friends. You know, how great is this?" And anyway, this is the story that gets passed down. It was the story that was on my mind when I ran across an old historical marker a few months ago and thought, hey, I can write a good anniversary story out of this.
Right. The problem is it might not be true. And you look at some of the writings of Carver himself, and it does seem pretty unlikely that, he would have transcribed this small paragraph. Let's drink the water. Let's drink. How clear the water. It just keeps going on and on. It doesn't seem exactly, verifiable.
I went down the rabbit hole a little bit because I thought, oh, I'll write a 250th anniversary story. And I asked a friend of mine, Bonnie Knight, who is a retired French teacher and who wrote a manuscript about the French fur trade up here, about, what do you know about this? And she says, well, it was Jonathan Carver, but, it might not have been, probably wasn't. And she sent me a little bit of her research. I looked at a few other things, and lo and behold, in his own diary, which you can get a copy of, he makes no mention of Eau Claire or its river. And he took very detailed notes about every little stream that flowed into the rivers he went down, and he didn't even mention that there was a river here. So,
right. So I want to hammer this home. Not only did he not have this story about the French voyageurs yelling Eau Claire, clear water," there's no indication that he actually saw the river at all at any point in his trip.
And it's hard to miss. I mean, he mentioned some other small streams around here that I've never even heard of. Made no mention of a big river, or a fairly big river, coming into the Chippewa. So I don't know if he was asleep in the canoe at the time or or what happened on his way up. He mentions seeing buffalo grazing a few miles downstream from here, kind of goes on, waxes about how big the buffalo were and how impressive they were, and talks about the falls upstream and what is now Chippewa Falls, and all the way along the Chippewa going into northern Wisconsin describes things, but no mention of Eau Claire.
Okay, so in the absence of that, where do you think this name came from?
Well, as I said, my friend Bonnie Knight had done some research on this, and again, I will not butcher the Ojibwa name, but apparently you go back in the records, and the Ojibwa people, who of course lived here before the French or the English, had a name for it that translates roughly as clear water, or the water of the river is clear, or the water is potable. I guess clear water sounds a little more poetic than potable. It makes sense that the folks that were here before the Europeans came would have a name for the river, and that when they talked to those Europeans, that's the name that got translated. When you go back, actually, in the history of the city of Eau Claire, when Europeans finally settled here almost a century after Carver came through, it was initially called Clearwater, and kind of went back and forth between being called Clearwater and Eau Claire until they actually incorporated the place. So I guess long story short, we can probably credit the Native Americans for that name.
And in the modern day, 250 years after Carver didn't name that river, I mean, do you still look at the Eau Claire River and think, that's a clear river compared to the muddier Chippewa?
That's the funny thing, is that, as I mentioned back in June when I was first starting about writing about this, I kind of looked at the water of both rivers, and they're both kind of brown. So I don't notice a qualitative difference. The river maybe is not as clean as it was 250 years ago. It's probably cleaner than it was 50 or 100 years ago, fortunately. We're not dumping parts from sawmills or rendering plants into it anymore, thank goodness. But, the water looks pretty much the same, but it still makes for a good story, I guess.
So what do you think? Does Eau Claire need to rethink its markers and its the story it tells itself about where its name came from?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of those things that some folks in the historical know probably knew all along. I mean, it's not as if this was some hidden knowledge that I'm the first person to uncover. In fact, you go down to Phoenix Park, which lies at the confluence of the two rivers, and there is a marker there that says, well, this story is probably a legend. Here's a couple of the takes on it. So maybe we need a little addendum on that one particular marker I ran across. But I think it's the whole story, and maybe telling it to young people and kids growing up is a good reminder that, hey, the Native Americans were here first, and we can probably credit a lot of the names we have to them, even if they were translated into a different language.
Well, I'll be looking at this city maybe a little differently next time I'm in your neck of the woods. Tom, thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Tom Giffey is editorial managing editor for Volume 1, talking about how the city of Eau Claire got its name.
There have been a lot of difficult conversations since the events in Charlottesville, Virginia earlier this month. A counter-protester was killed at a white supremacist rally after a man rammed his car into a crowd. The white supremacists gathered in Charlottesville to protest the removal of Confederate statues.
One extremely difficult conversation about this news is with your kids. And we want to hear from you now at 800-642-1234. How do you talk to your children about events like this? How do you explain issues of race or racial inequalities with your children? And if you're a teacher, how do you address these topics in your classroom? You can call in at 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Andrew Grant Thomas is the co-founder of Embrace Race, a community of support for parents and other caregivers working to raise, their aim is to raise informed, thoughtful, and brave children. Andrew, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, it's good to be with you.
Well, the main case you seem to be making at Embrace Race is that it's important for parents to start talking to their kids about race. Why is it important?
For one, certainly it's important to start talking. It's important to start talking early because, first and foremost, because kids are developing their racial sensibilities very, very early, right? So, you know, we know that at 6 months, literally at 6 months even earlier, kids are making distinctions on the base, certainly can make distinctions on the base of race. And we know that, you know, by the time they end their kindergarten, most kids are making value judgments about on the basis of race, right? About associating good and bad, positive and negative qualities with members of different racial groups. So, yeah, we need to start talking early.
And what led you and your wife to decide to found Embrace Race?
So it's definitely a big mix of things. So on the personal side, right, I immigrated from Jamaica to the U.S. as a boy, a black boy of 7 years old. And certainly our experience, the experience of my family in the U.S., was decidedly shaped by race. My wife, too, is biracial. She was born in this country, but her born of immigrant parents. So, you know, race was salient. Race and ethnicity were salient for her family and mine. Then professionally, I've been doing race work and racial justice research and advocacy work for a long time. And my wife, Melissa, spent a lot of time on K-12 education and especially the education of, you know, Latino immigrants and girls of color. But I think the, you know, the crowning factor was becoming parents to two brown-skinned girls who are now 6 and 9 and looking for the resources and community of support to help them, to help us, help them negotiate race, its challenges and opportunities, and realizing that there actually was very little out there. There are definitely excellent organizations aimed at helping teachers in the classroom, but much less aimed at helping parents and other caregivers outside of the classroom and outside of the school context.
Andrew, I think a lot of adults have trouble talking to each other about race and maybe even doing it in the first place. What are some ways to get started with, say, younger kids to start to have productive conversations about what race means?
Well, certainly, you know, there's going to be, it obviously depends somewhat on age, but you're going to want to think about how to be both reactive, right, responsive to what they're bringing to you or what the world brings to your family, and proactive. So number one, I mean, I think you really want to legitimize a conversation with your kids. Race is not only okay to talk about, it's good to talk about, right? And when they bring it up, whatever context that might be, it might be about books, it might be about their friends, school, happenings, things in the neighborhood, patterns that they notice. I think the first thing is, yeah, great. That's an interesting observation. Let's have that conversation rather than squash it, which a lot of parents, especially white parents, try to do. And then, you know, there are any number of ways to think about engaging race. And it's not only about talking. That's really important. So, you know, just to give one example from my own family, you know, again, my girls are 6 and 9. They've had a lot of babysitters over the years. And one thing we've tried to do, which we haven't done nearly as well as we might have, frankly, is in trying to get babysitters, right, where we try to get babysitters who are both male and female, right, and who have all racial stripes, not least so that I, as a black man and black father, I'm not the only male of color they see as a loving provider for them. So that's just a specific example, but there's actually a lot of things we can do.
We're talking to Andrew Grant Thomas about raising kids and talking about race and issues of race with them. He's a co-founder of Embrace Race. Andrew, we heard ahead of the show from Sean on Facebook who wrote, Martin Luther King Jr. was colorblind. To be colorblind is to try to see people for who they are as a person, not as a member of their race, to judge them by the content of their character, not their skin color. This isn't, Sean writes, mutually exclusive with recognizing racial trends and fighting for equality of opportunity. But this idea Sean's bringing up of maybe we should be working toward colorblindness, you've written elsewhere that doesn't necessarily work out with kids.
Yeah, it doesn't. So, you know, first of all, I'm going to disagree with Sean's premise. I mean, that King was colorblind. I know the content of their character quote is his most famous one. But, you know, consider that he was killed in Memphis and he had come back to Memphis having been there a few months earlier, you know, helping the striking sanitation workers in Memphis. Right. I mean, he knew that the economy certainly wasn't colorblind. But more to the real thrust of Sean's point, I mean, I think on one hand, we can certainly have a talk about whether or not we should aspire to colorblindness, and that might be something we want to do. There are also arguments why it might not be something we want to do, but that's very, aspiring to colorblindness is very different from insisting that the world and our society as it is now is already colorblind, right? So, you know, in a world, in a society which criminal justice and the economy and healthcare and education and employment are all profoundly race conscious, pretending not to see race when most people and most organizations and most institutions are very race conscious, really is only hurting the people who are most vulnerable to begin with.
I want to bring on a caller now. We've got Jason on the line in Madison. Jason, hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up, Jason?
Well, I have two children. I have a 13-year-old daughter and a 9-year-old son, and they have access to social media, and they pay attention to this kind of stuff. And long before, you know, this last huge incident happened, they had questions, and I was put in a position where I had to either pick, you know, the parenting sugarcoat method of don't worry about that, you're too young, I'll take care of it, or, you know, listen. And so they don't think there's anything wrong with someone being a different color. My daughter is a part of a group in her middle school that welcomes transgenders and all the different choices that kids can make. And so I've never looked at other people as what you see. I teach my kids that everybody is just like us, which is one second we believe something, the next second we doubt it, the third second we believe it again. And that's how people work. So if you try to identify somebody as a certain type of person, well, then you're just giving, you're doing yourself a disservice. And so I want to tell other parents that if you want your kids to grow up to be open-minded and reasonable, that they can't ever assume, because none of us have met everybody. None of us will ever meet everybody. And because there's so many options of how to be and how to think, labeling somebody based on color or any of those things, especially religious choices and such, that's just, it doesn't even make sense.
Jason, thanks a lot for the call. Andrew, your thoughts on what Jason had to say?
Yeah, well, I appreciate Jason's comment. I guess there are a couple of things to say. On one hand, of course, he's right, right? So there are millions of African-American people, millions more white people, Latinx people, Asian-Americans, Native Americans, and so on, multiracial people. And there are huge differences, right? There are all the differences you can possibly imagine within each of those groups. So to say that we know someone on the basis of racial identity alone clearly doesn't make sense. On the other hand, as far as that goes, I certainly agree with Jason. On the other hand, the truth is that in this society, we make these distinctions, right? So, you know, let me name just one, but this is not just my sort of personal sense of things. We have tons and tons of research, right, that takes sort of our subjective opinions out of it and tells us what, in fact, we see. So, you know, think about the fact, for example, that our social networks, our friendship circles, are very segregated, right? We know this. There was a survey done a few years ago in which 75% of white Americans had no close friends who were non-white. Almost as many African Americans, that was true of almost as many African Americans, and true of roughly half of Latino respondents. There in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee, a sociologist named David Pager did a very well-known study looking at whether or not, looking at black and white men who had criminal records or did not have criminal records, and whether and how they were able to get jobs. And what she found is that white men with criminal records did better, right, were more successful in the labor market than black men without criminal records. So, again, we can aspire for ourselves, for our society, for our kids to be, quote-unquote, colorblind. But the truth is the society is colorblind. The truth is also that we individually are colorblind. And if Jason's kids are, 13 and 9, I think he said, to think that they don't see race, that at school they're not talking with their peers and friends about race, is frankly, unless they're the most unusual and perhaps unique kids in the country, it's frankly just not true.
Andrew Grant Thomas is with us. He's co-founder of Embrace Race. We're talking about the idea of raising race-conscious kids.
And we want to hear from you on this at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about talking to your children about race? How do you handle issues of racial inequity when they come up with your kids? Teachers, what issues and ideas do you have when it comes to tackling these different issues when it comes to your younger students. You can call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. We're picking up our discussion now about talking to your kids about race and racial issues now with Andrew Grant Thomas. He's the co-founder of Embrace Race.
You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, experiences, and questions. How do you handle issues of race with your own kids or grandkids? Are these issues you bring up or that you try to steer clear of? Do you steer clear of it on purpose or because you don't know what to say? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Andrew, how about that situation I just mentioned? A parent thinking, yeah, I want to talk about issues of race with my kids. I don't know what to do or where to start. How do you recommend they get started and maybe look for resources too?
Well, certainly that's why we're here. I mean, we Embrace Race alone can't fill the gap. It's enormous, but we have a website and a newsletter. The newsletter, for example, is bi-monthly, and every time it comes out, we have a resource section, resources that parents can use in engaging their kids, whether it's about talking or something else. Facebook page where we're posting 3 articles a day that we think will be helpful to people. So there's that, and there's certainly other resources. Again, not so many, but they are proliferating, right? Precisely as you said at the top, because of this time that we live in, because more and more people are recognizing how much racial content there is in a way that we used not to recognize. And Robbie, and I just wanted to add just one last thing to Jason's point about his kids, which is, maybe here's one way of thinking about it. We like to think that kids, and especially white children, are colorblind, but human beings in general, and certainly children, and all of us, are really good at recognizing patterns, right? And we're really good at recognizing racial patterns. So whether it's about, who goes to my school versus another school, who lives in the homes in that neighborhood versus this one, who plays on this team in school versus that one, who dates whom, who's friends with whom, they recognize that. That's a given, right? There's not much we can do about that, and it's not obvious we should want to do anything in particular about that. The really crucial question is, what kind of explanations do our kids come to about the patterns that they see, and where are they going to get those explanations from? Are they getting them from us? Do we have some input? Are they more or less informed, more or less thoughtful ones, or are they just pulling it in from the popular culture, from their peers, whatever it may be? I think that's where we need to focus our attention.
I want to bring on another caller now. Martha is with us in Menominee. Martha, hi.
Yes, hello. This is a great discussion. I don't know if you can raise totally colorblind kids, but you can raise colorly aware kids. And it's not so much what they see, it's how they respond to what they see and how they act. Actions are louder than, any explanation a parent gives. So, first of all, my color-aware child was raised by a black grandmother and white parents. And so at family reunions, it was rainbow out there. So she's had the advantage of growing up from a very young age, exposed to all cultures, and it's been rich. She moved to Menominee, Wisconsin as a fourth grader, walked in her class, sat next to who we call in our family Tiny Bowman, which is a generic name for anyone who's very big and overweight. I walk in 3 days later. I look at the class. She says, "Mom, I'm sitting next to Tiny Bowman." I walk in. She's sitting next to the only African-American child in the class. This is in fourth grade. You got to give kids a little more credit. I think that if you bring up race too early and talk, you're wasting your time. Kids are very aware of this. It's all over Facebook, these little interviews with these adorable children. Tell me how you're different from your friend. Well, he likes horses. I like dogs.
Mm. Martha, thanks for the call. So a couple points there, having role models, different family members in this case, but just being aware and exposed to people from different backgrounds. But then on the other hand, Martha says, don't talk about race too early. So your thoughts, Andrew?
Well, it's I'm not sure what we can get from particular anecdotes, right? So, You know, it's not as if no one suggests that kids notice only race, right? As if the only thing characteristic that's important to them is, you know, the racial identity of the kid they're sitting next to. So I'm not sure that, you know, identifying, you know, sort of thinking of the black kid she was sitting next to, you know, share some characteristic with another kid who wasn't black. I'm not sure what that tells us. Again, what we know, it's important, I think, to, you know, where we can to actually pay attention to what seems to be the rule, right, rather than to what may or may not be exceptions, which is why, you know, I hesitate sort of to talk. I certainly don't rely in what we're doing in Embrace Race on anecdotal accounts. We really do have very, very strong evidence that whether kids refer to race or not, they see race, right? And they make inferences about race. And in fact, very often when kids, certainly by the time a kid is in fourth grade, let's say 9 or 10 years old, she has already learned that many adults, perhaps all the adults in her life, think it's a bad idea, right, that race is a taboo subject. So we have, you know, we have these scenarios where, for example, we'll, you know, they do experiments where kids are asked to describe photographs of people to each other, right? So I have a partner, I have in front of me, you know, a picture of someone, and one of the obvious ways to describe the person might be to say, this is a white boy, or this is a, you know, a black boy, or whatever it is. And even in those circumstances, many kids will not, most kids will not describe the racial identity of the person, even in a competitive situation where doing that would allow them to win the game. Right? So, you know, it's not that they don't notice race, it's that we've told them it's wrong to notice race and wrong to talk about it.
Andrew, as we wrap up, you talk about a tip you give at Embrace Race, and on your website, embraceRace.org, is to prepare for a marathon, not a sprint, when it comes to talking with kids about race. What do you mean by that?
Yeah, you know, I think we, so many parents, and again, I think white parents in particular, but not exclusively white parents, are, as you said earlier, Rob, are nervous about talking about race, maybe because they don't know how to do it effectively, even if they think it's the right thing to do. And of course, as we've heard on a couple of these calls, there are some parents who think we really shouldn't talk about race or shouldn't talk about race until, you know, the kid is older rather than younger. And that sort of concern, that kind of fear or trepidation in some cases, can lead people to, you know, place so much emphasis on the talk, right? The race conversation. It's too much pressure, and it's actually not quite the way to think about it. The conversation I have when my daughters were 4 or 5 is a different conversation than I have when they are 7 or 8, and that'll be different again than when they're, you know, 11, 12, and so on. And it's okay to not get it quite right. It's okay to not quite have the answers. It's okay to say, let me get back to you, or let's do some research on that. It's over time, right? It's what's the exposure, what's the conversation, what's the learning over time, both in terms of the conversations we have and what we actually do.
Andrew, that's all the time we have. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Rob, I really appreciate it. Take good care.
You too. That's Andrew Grant Thomas, co-founder of Embrace Race. You can find the group's tip sheet and keep this conversation going over on the Central Time Facebook page.